valuable to me than that seat, than that khilafah. It's more valuable to me. But I stand by it because Allah commanded me for that. I will protect it because Allah has given me that. It is mine. But it's not because I want power. It's because I need to save you. I need to give justice to you. Who's going to guide you? Who's going to give you justice? This is the power of Imam Ali alayhi salam. That when he says that to Maytham al-Tammar, that Maytham is killed because he says you can handle it. Some people can't handle it. That Imam Ali alayhi salam was on the death state. So people ask, how come Allah did not mention the name of Imam Ali in this surah? Or in this ayah, for example, إِنَّمَا وَلِيكُمُ اللَّهِ. When he says, وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا. Why not just say, وَأَمِيرُ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ عَلِي بْنِ أَبِي طَالِبٍ. Why don't you mention this name? People ask. It is not in the spirit of the Quran. Look at the wisdom of Allah. Allah doesn't mention a single companion of the Prophet in the entire Quran except one. And his name was Zayd, who was his adopted son. And only strategically his name is mentioned. Why? All the companions, none of their names are mentioned. Because it's not the style of the Quran to be giving us stories with names. The Quran has remained silent for all the companions of the Prophet. Do you know why? Subhanallah. Look at the wisdom of the Quran. The Quran is a book of principles. It's not a book of stories. And if there is a story in it, it's because there's a principle behind it. Otherwise, the Quran doesn't tell us. Even the Quran is silent about how many people were in the cave. Quran in Surah Al-Kahf, they say, you argue, there were 5 and 6 as a dog, 6 and 7. No, I'm not going to tell you. You say to Allah, why don't you tell me? Because Allah says, it's not important for you. I'll tell you only if it's important. And if numbers are given to you, it's important. You will find out later in time about this number. So Imam Ali's name is not mentioned because you and I have been commanded, إِنَّمَا الْمُؤْمِنُونَ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا بِاللَّهِ وَرَسُولِي ثُمَّ لَمْ يَرْتَابُوا وَجَاهَدُوا بِأَمْوَالِهِمْ وَأَنفُسِهِمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ. The believers are the ones who believe in Allah and His Messenger. Through the Messenger, we get all the regulations.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's programme, we'll be looking at an obscure venture known as the UK-Israel Tech Hub. It's run out of the British Embassy in the Zionist entity, and facilitates the penetration of Israeli tech firms into the UK economy. Former British government minister Matt Hancock described it as a different way of doing diplomacy. I'll be talking to experts on this issue after this special report by Latifa Abouchakra about the UK-Israel tech hub.
There are over 500 Israeli companies operating in the UK. Over 80 of them are Israeli tech startups. In fact, there are more Israeli tech firms in the UK than any other country in Europe. Part of the reason for that is a little-known organisation operating out of the British Embassy in occupied Palestine. The UK-Israel Tech Hub is a glaring example of state capture. The organisation is dedicated to obtaining contracts in both the British private and public sector for Israeli tech companies. Palestine Declassified has previously shown how many Israeli tech companies are used to disguise the agency of Zionist intelligence services. The UK-Israel Tech Hub is based in the British Embassy in 48 occupied Palestine and is funded directly by the British taxpayer. Through the British Foreign Office, along with departments for trade and media, this organisation committed to Israel's economic and tech interests is funded. When glancing at the employees of this organisation who sit inside of the British Embassy, the picture of state capture becomes clearer. The chairman of the UK-Israel Tech Hub goes by the name of Chaim Sherney. He was previously Director General of the Israeli Finance Ministry and was recently awarded the honor of an OBE from late Queen Elizabeth for his work on the UK-Israel Tech Hub. The director of this suspicious organization is Karen Shirkin, who started in the liaison department of the Israeli military. The deputy director of the UK-Israel Tech Hub is Ella Kaplan, who claims to have been directly behind all interactions between a specific foreign army and the Israel military during her time in the liaison department. Hadar Haberman is the clean growth sector lead at the organization and previously was an employee of the Israeli Ministry of Science and Technology. Avital Levitsky went from working in Israeli military intelligence to the cybersecurity sector lead at the UK-Israel Tech Hub in the British Embassy. Ronit Applebaum used to work for the Israeli Ministry of Health and today holds an important role at the Tech Hub. Program manager at the organization, Tagil Yaniv, was also employed by the Israeli Ministry of Tourism. As Britain's Minister for International Trade stated, UK-Israel Tech Hub creates partnerships between British companies and world-class Israeli innovators.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David's a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog, Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Mick Napier. Mick's the chair of the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign and a long-time champion of Palestinian rights. He's recently been campaigning on the activities of Israeli tech firms in surveillance activities in Scotland. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you. Tell us something about this UK-Israel tech hub then.
Well, it's a very curious thing, isn't it? It sounds like it's a company, but it's not. It's an operation from inside the British Embassy in Tel Aviv. And it's there to encourage integration between the tech industry in the UK and in Israel. And, of course, as the film showed, there is a huge integration already happening. And as the film shows, really a large number of people have gone straight from working for the Zionist entity into effectively working for the British taxpayer. Mm-hmm. And really, given all of the concerns that have been expressed in this programme on many occasions, we're seeing a penetration, essentially, into the very fabric of British governance of operatives of the Zionist regime.
Mm. I mean, Mick, what do you make of the British government using public money to fund the expansion of Israeli economic interests in the UK? I mean, as I said in the introduction there, the former British government minister, Matt Hancock, simply described it as just a different way of doing diplomacy.
Thanks for having me, Chris. By the way, I'm no longer chair of the campaign. I'm still on the National Committee. This is some job creation program. It would be great if they would do some job creation programs like this in the UK, where it's greatly needed. But good wages, and they're working out at the British Embassy to facilitate trade with Israel. Now, Israel often manages to offload the costs of its own efforts. Palestinian prisoners actually often have to pay for their own food. So this comes as shocking, but it's not surprising that this is the situation. It's part of 100% full spectrum complicity between the British state and the Israeli state, diplomatic, political, military. But I have to say, this still comes as a shock. Wow, what a job creation program, Chris.
Yeah, indeed. Well, I mean, David, I mean, is it possible, do you think, that these contracts are being used simply as a sort of data grab for the Israeli intelligence?
Well, the link with intelligence is of course, one which is not surprising and which comes out, of the attempts from some years ago of the Netanyahu government to send people from Israeli intelligence organizations, in particular the Signals Intelligence Unit, Unit 8200, mm-hmm. into the tech startups. Now, they're foreseen as sort of emissaries of the Zionist regime. So these are not just people who've gone off into business. These are people who are intended by the regime to carry the interests of the Israeli state into the startups that they're engaged in. And that's part of the whole genesis of this strategy of startup nation that the Israelis are always going on about. This is partly about foreign policy aims and objectives as well as simply business objectives.
Mm. Mick, how does a project like this impact, do you think, on the effectiveness of the boycott, divestment and sanctions campaign?
Well, it's very clearly aimed to defeat it as far as it possibly can. I mean, the interesting thing about one of the Glasgow initiatives to deploy an Israeli military-grade surveillance system in central Glasgow, by the way, as a pilot, which if it goes ahead is not challenged, might be deployed in other UK cities. The key thing about it is that it had to be done in the dark. There was no public debate. There was nothing on Glasgow City Council. There was nothing in the Scottish Parliament. It was kept very, very silent indeed before that system was deployed. So they know that it's very, very unpopular. They know that if there were a widespread public conversation, how many people in Glasgow would actually agree to have technology deployed on their city streets with emotional recognition software, which can pick up on you if you're having a bad day and then follow you around the city, bring in all your social media posts and decide if you're a person of interest to Police Scotland. I think the Israelis know, the British also are well aware that Israel is deeply unpopular and that these operations have to be surrounded by a cloud. They can't be done. They can't be dragged out into the open because they do not enjoy public support. There is no mandate for the examples that I know of, and to date, even though this technology was deployed 8-9 years ago, there has still been no public debate on the topic, and I've yet to meet anyone in Glasgow who approves. Not of CCTV. I mean, CCTV can be used to find murderers. It's been quite useful on some occasions. But this kind of highly intrusive Israeli military-grade surveillance, which locks onto demonstrations, identifies people of interest, and even identifies ordinary Glaswegians going about their business, and then decides to dig very deeply into their private life. It raises very fundamental questions, yeah. Not just about transparency or the complete lack of it. It raises fundamental questions about the right to a private life. Perhaps that's one of the reasons why it is dealt with so, I think, furtively.
Yeah. Well, David, tell us about Britain's role in establishing the Israeli military in the first place.
Well, we did a show on this a while ago, and there was this Irish guy who was involved in setting up the Jewish Legion, which was fought in the British military, indeed fought in Jerusalem. And amongst its leaders was the revisionist Zionist, Vladimir Jabotinsky, changed his name later to Zev Jabotinsky, one of the leaders of the organisation which became the Irgun, the terror gang, which was involved, in bombing British soldiers and officers, and indeed in the massacres of Arab and Palestinian civilians. So this organisation was the kind of the kernel of what became the IDF, the Jewish Legion, and the British Army. So the British Army effectively, organisationally set up the IDF, even though in its birth the Irgun and other Zionist terror gangs were involved actually in committing terrorism against the British Empire, but you know that's the origin of the IDF.
Very interesting. Mick, just to remind us, will you, about Britain's part in developing Israeli apartheid during the mandate period as well?
Well, David's mentioned the military side of it. Can I just add a little tidbit? Horrific though. Matthew Hughes in the Journal of Imperial History has an article about how the British brutalised Jewish troops during the mandate. Now, that doesn't mean how Israeli troops brutalised Palestinians by beating and smashing them up. What he meant was that British troops like Wingate and others trained Israeli soldiers in the methods of counterinsurgency, attacking civilians, attacking innocent villages that had been perfected throughout the British Empire. Look, Israel's a species of colonialism, actually settler colonialism. You can't have that without a species of apartheid. I mean, on a clear day, you can look from Scotland to Northern Ireland, and over there, we still have, despite the end of the war, we still have walls between communities. Yes. Britain deliberately divided communities against each other, and in Palestine, they did so on steroids.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that, Mick. We're just going to pause there for a moment. This report now on how Israeli firms are penetrating the National Health Service in the UK.
The UK-Israel Tech Hub is a body through which Israel pursues its economic and digital interest in Britain. But is it serving other interests related to espionage? Here, the former director of the organization, Aidan Fisher, can barely conceal his glee that the British taxpayer is funding the integration of the Israeli and British economies.
So the Hub is a very unique initiative. It's actually funded by the British government. We're based at the embassy in Tel Aviv, just opposite the Hilton Hotel. It's actually the stage in which we operate. A lot of the time, the money actually flows from the UK to Israel. We find ourselves helping Israeli companies, especially if they're in their seed or round A stage, because we have an interest. Our interest is to increase the stickiness, to increase the ties between the UK and Israel.
Palestine Declassified previously revealed the 2012 Netanyahu policy of moving agents of Israeli military intelligence, Unit 8200, into private companies to continue their work. Is the UK-Israel Tech Hub a vehicle for that? It should be disconcerting for British taxpayers to note that the British embassy-backed project has been integral to the signing of a memorandum of understanding between Israel and the Northern Health Services Alliance to facilitate the expansion of the Israeli tech industry into the NHS. Through the tech hub, something called the UK-Israel Health Tech Gateway has been established, which will give Israeli tech companies access to vast swathes of health data on British citizens. The UK-Israel Tech Hub has been extensively supported by previous subjects of the Palestine Declassified investigation, British Telecom and Mishkon Derea. This is all symptomatic of a much wider push at economic, digital and intelligence integration between Britain and Israel, as outlined in a research paper for the largest Israel lobby group in the country, BICOM. The paper even seems to ominously imply that the British ambassador to Israel may have been cultivated by the Zionists, stating, "The UK and Israeli national strategies for addressing cyber challenges have developed in parallel with acknowledged cross-fertilization between them. It is perhaps no coincidence that former UK ambassador to Israel, Matthew Gold, returned from his posting in Tel Aviv in 2015 to become director of cybersecurity at the UK Cabinet Office. The document also asserts that the UK's National Security Establishment's program, Cyber Discovery, which grooms children into cybersecurity professionals, on the Maximum program in Israeli school. The Maximum is the infamous Unit 8200 school program that cultivates children to be Israeli spies. The level of digital integration between Israel and Britain has reached unprecedented levels, with an anonymous senior British official describing Israel as a first-order partner in cybersecurity. It would seem wise to wonder what data former Israeli spies have access to through such integration.
David, what do you make of this BICOM paper that lays out extensive digital collaboration between Britain and Israel?
Well, integration is the word that they're using, and it does seem to be a really very significant melding between British activities and Israeli activities. And, of course, these are not just business activities. These are also, as we've seen in the film there, activities which have an intelligence component or an intelligence interest. So the involvement there in the health tech hub, for example, very worrying that Israeli tech firms staffed by people from formerly in Israeli intelligence agencies are able to get access to data in the British National Health Service. Now, you know, the National Health Service is seen by everyone in this country as being a massive achievement, but are we really opening up the access, the data in the NHS to Israeli startups and indeed possibly to Israeli intelligence organizations? Can that really be the idea that most people have of what the NHS is for?
Well, Mick, I mean, Aidan Fisher, the former director of the UK-Israel Tech Hub, can barely contain himself when asked about British funding. I mean, is this what state capture looks like, do you think?
It's a quid pro quo. Israel makes itself very useful to Britain and to the West in general. I mean, one Israeli prime minister described Israel as disgusting language, a villa in the jungle. Herzl himself said it was an outpost of European civilization among savages of a sort. So Israel's there as an extension a crusader state, if you like, which can be called upon, if need be, to deal with anyone who stands up to Western diktat. So I'm not surprised that the integration is so close. Now, your viewers may even know about Jonathan Pollard. Jonathan Pollard was an American who actually stole container loads of American secrets and delivered them to Israel, for which he was given a life sentence, released recently. Of course, Israel will use this access in order to steal data. That's what states do. The problem is, and it's a very pressing problem, is that the surveillance system I've already alluded to in Glasgow, it is sold on the strength of massive surveillance and then rapid integration of the individual who's identified with their social media posts. But even there, health data was deemed to be off limits. Now, once they get access to health data, then all sorts of blackmail becomes possible. And you have to remember that 43 Israeli soldiers, and they were Zionists, resigned from the unit that's mothered all this technology because it was used in order to surveil and blackmail Palestinians. This is malign technology. And once it gets access, it breaks the barrier into medical data. Yeah. Then the warning issued by those Israeli soldiers that it can be used to blackmail, intimidate, force people to collaborate, force people to change their political behavior becomes even more serious. So I think this information that you're uncovering is very, very significant for British people.
Yeah. David, tell us why Unit 8200, the Israeli intelligence corps, is relevant to this conversation then.
Well, it's relevant in many ways. First of all, what we've already been saying, which is the travelling of people who used to be in this Israeli intelligence agency into tech startups and therefore into the corporate world where they can get access to data. But also this Machamim program, where they have this training program essentially to groom children to become Israeli intelligence agents. And that program itself has been taken over and transposed by GCHQ in this country to bring kids into the intelligence services here. Wow. So we have a parallel there as well. And that's not the end of it. I mean, this is really a problem about the many ways in which Israeli intelligence are able to access data in this country. Mick's talking about the surveillance program, there's the health question, and then of course there's the involvement, now, as we've seen in the previous program, of Patrick Drahi, the Zionist billionaire, who's now the largest single stakeholder, shareholder in British Telecom. Yeah. So there's a really significant issue here of multiple sources of data available to Israeli intelligence over almost all British citizens.
Mm. Well, Mick, what do you think the ramifications of the UK-Israel health tech gateway could actually be then?
Now, look, people joke that most countries, most states have an army, but the Israeli army has a state. What they mean is that the military so saturates and penetrates every aspect of the Israeli economy, political and social life, that you can't divide them off. And when these tech companies get an entry into British economic life, into the health service, for example, you're giving it to the Israeli military. Now, we remember that Huawei was supposed to be stripped out of its core functions in the British telecommunications structures because it could be used by the Communist Party. I mean, we were told that we had to be wary of TikTok because the Chinese Communist Party could use it. It became ridiculous. But it's not ridiculous to say that the Israeli security establishment will be directing these capitalists, will be directing these industrialists, and these industrialists will have no freedom of maneuver compared to the Israeli security establishment. So, yes, they've already got themselves a significant position in the UK pharmaceutical industry. The pharmacy industry, where something called Teva supplies a lot of pharmaceuticals. Yeah. Once again, that's all done behind the scenes. Nobody, if it were called Israeli drugs, nobody would buy them, but it's already there significantly. So, yeah, it's very worrying.
Well, David, tell us about this Magshimim program in Israeli schools and its application in Britain.
So, I mean, as I was saying, I mean, this program is about grooming children to become intelligence agents, and they go through hacker training programs and competitions. And there are hacker competitions. One of the guys who set up the Wix company, W-I-X, one of the startups there, he was a previous winner of an internal Unit 8200 hacking program where he hacked into the computers of three hostile states. Now, we don't know which ones they were, but we could imagine which ones they were. Mm. And he went on then to form this web company. People still have websites on the Wix, using the Wix software. And the same thing's been happening in the UK. There, GCHQ runs competitions like that. And there's the integration, which is the worrying thing. For example, the guy who was the ambassador in Tel Aviv, Matthew Gould, who went on to become the director of cybersecurity in the cabinet office. And, of course, his next job after that was to be involved with the cyber work in tech work in the health service.
Yes.
So he was actually overseeing the Israeli involvement in the health service technology. So that's a really significant problem there.
Are there any other similar examples, you think, like Matthew Gould? Or, I mean, was he a one-off?
Well, there's an integration increasingly between the interests of the Israelis and parts of the government apparatus in this country. So Gould is one example. There are many other examples of people who are effectively operating for the interests of the Israelis inside the governmental apparatus in Whitehall and in Westminster.
Oh, very interesting. Well, I'm afraid that we're out of time today. I hope you found the programme informative again. I want to thank our guests, Mick Napier, and our resident expert, of course, Professor David Miller. And thank you for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
There are many reasons, explanations and excuses being given for the disastrous state of Britain's economy. Yet, what we see today in this country is just myths. A series of protests have recently filled the streets of the largest UK cities with people rallying for causes ranging from a cost of living crisis and pay rises to protecting the climate. According to statistics, the UK has lost its place among the world's top five financial superpowers. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Guardian reported more than 100,000 postal workers have begun the first of a series of days of strike action that threaten to disrupt deliveries across the UK in the run-up to Christmas. After the failure of 11th-hour talks to resolve a protracted and bitter dispute over pay and conditions, the Communications Workers Union, CWU, which has planned 6 days of strikes, on December 24th, 23rd, 15th and 14th, has organized the protests by workers at the Houses of Parliament as a row with management continues to escalate. The CWU said at least 15,000 of its members would head to Westminster for what it claimed would be the bigger ever demonstration held by postal workers. Royal Mail buses are risking a Christmas meltdown because of their stubborn refusal to treat their employees with respect, said Dave Ward, the CWU General Secretary, adding, postal workers want to get on with serving the communities they belong to, delivering Christmas gifts and tackling the backlog from recent weeks, but they know their value. Royal Mail, which has warned customers to post Christmas cards and presents early to make sure they arrive on time, has accused the union of holding Christmas to ransom. The company, which had its offer of up to 9% for workers rejected, has argued that Royal Mail needs to restructure as it is losing £1 million a day and said it may need to cut up to 10,000 jobs by August. The company is facing 18 days of strikes this year if all the planned action takes place. It has said the 8 days of strikes until November 16th cost it £100 million. The dispute began this summer after Royal Mail rejected union demands for a pay rise that matched inflation, which is currently 11.1%. A spokesperson for the company said, "We spent three more days at Akas this week to discuss what needs to happen for the strikes to be lifted. In the end, all we received was another request for more pay without the changes needed to fund the pay offer. A strike action has already cost our people £1,200 each. The money allocated to the pay deal risks being eaten away by the cost of further strike action. The CWU is striking at our busiest time, deliberately holding Christmas to ransom for our customers, businesses and families across the country," he said. Last month, Royal Mail asked the government to allow it to stop delivering letters on Saturdays, arguing it was financially unsustainable after it reported £219 million loss in the 6 months to September. The embattled company, which last month warned it may need to cut up to 10,000 jobs by August, made £235 million profits in the same period last year. Meanwhile, Forbes noted those planning to spend the holidays in Great Britain should prepare for a side helping of humbug as thousands of rail and air workers get set to strike throughout the season. The British government is warning travellers of disruptions and long queues over the busy Christmas holiday period due to planned strikes by passport control workers at major airports across England, Scotland and Wales. Great Britain's Interior Minister Suella Braverman warned recently that up to 3,000 airport staff working for UK Border Force, the equivalent of Customs and Border Patrol, are set to walk out on 8 days over holidays. The disruptions are likely to impact travellers entering rather than departing the country. Targeted airports include the UK's busiest London Heathrow, as well as London Gatwick, Manchester, Birmingham, Cardiff and Glasgow. With nearly 200,000 members, the Public and Commercial Services Union, known as PCS, is the largest union of British government workers. Three out of four British passport control staff are PCS members. The government can stop these strikes tomorrow if it puts money on the table, said PCS General Secretary Mark Serwotka. Union members are seeking a 10% pay rise, better job security and related assurances. The British government is planning to bring in soldiers to help with passport control and other functions, but processing arrivals is expected to be slower on strike days, so travellers should pack their patience. Meanwhile, train travel in Britain is also going to be messy this holiday season. Network Rail, which manages most of the railway network in Great Britain, is warning of significantly reduced train services across from December 13th to January 8th. The UK's largest rail union, DRMT, has announced strikes on 8 different days over the holiday season, December 13th, 14th, 16th and 17th, also January 3rd, 4th, 6th and 7th. RMT members are looking for better pay and working conditions. National Rail, previously British Rail, is not sugarcoating the situation. This is likely to affect most train companies across Britain, says its website, adding, "It is inevitable that services will be cancelled or severely disrupted. It is likely that there will be a very limited service on these days with no trains at all on some routes. Our message to the public is we are sorry to inconvenience you, but we urge you to direct your anger and frustration at the government and railway employers during this latest phase of action," said RMT General Secretary Mick Lynch.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Topic that we are going to delve into today or in the upcoming episodes probably is Nazr. And that's what we are going to do according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we continue our program, let's take a listen to short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Manjo, the host in this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. The topic that we are still, beginning to talk about from the last episode onwards is Nazr or Vow. Sheikh Javid, you kindly provided us with a good definition and some of the conditions of Nazr, but I want to ask you about full detail, requirement and conditions of Nazr. What are those conditions and requirements?
Well, first of all, I would like to say that it is necessary that the person making a vow should have attained the age of legal responsibility.
Right.
Now, if a child wants to make a vow, his vow is not binding. It's not. It does not have any effect. And this is the first requirement. The second requirement is that the person who makes a vow should be sane, okay, should be in his senses, and he should do it consciously and, of course, deliberately. And this is the second condition. And then the person should make the vow with free will, okay? Free will. It means he should do it of his own choice, of his own accord, and he should do it with intention, okay? Intention. And if a person, for example, let's say if a person is coerced or forced or compelled to make a vow, and if he, if he makes it under compulsion, makes a vow under compulsion, of course, the vow will not be obligatory. And also if a person makes a vow owing to excitement, okay, mm-hmm. because he's excited, he's, yes. let's say he's not in very in proper condition, and he did not mean to make a vow, but because he was excited, he did it, his vow is not in order.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I see.
So, and I would like to further explain this. You know, if a person who is, let's say, feeble-minded, a person who is not able to tell the difference between good and bad, okay, he is, we call it as a feeble-minded or safi. A safi is a person who squanders his property for useless purposes. He wastes his money
mm-hmm.
without even himself knowing that he is wasting his money. So he's actually a feeble-minded person.
Mm-hmm.
So such a person, if he makes a vow, for example, to give something to the poor or to do something, actually, his vow is not in order either.
Or valid.
Yeah, and the same is the case with, let's say, with a bankrupt who is interdicted, yes, because he is a mahjur according to Islamic Sharia. And a mahjur is someone who is interdicted, who is unable to touch his money, for many reasons, because he owes other people a lot of money.
Right.
So one of those people who is interdicted is a feeble-minded person, and another person who is interdicted and who has no right to use, no right of discretion over his property, is a bankrupt individual who is insolvent and unable to pay back his money, to pay off his loan. So if a bankrupt individual or an insolvent individual makes a vow to pay from the wealth over which he has no right of disposal or discretion, of course, the vow will not be valid. And of course, if such a vow is made, this vow is not binding.
Shasha, with a very quick question, what about underage individuals or children?
I think I said that the person who makes a vow should have attained the age of legal responsibility. The first condition.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohammed Jad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. The topic we are talking about is Nazr or vow. Well, Sheikh Javid, can a husband make a vow for his wife or revoke it or cancel it? What about a father in relation to his children, his son, for example?
First of all, I would like to say that a person cannot make a vow on another person's behalf. In other words, it's not right, it's not permissible to make a vow and get someone else involved in the vow, okay? Because that person should have, that person has nothing to do with the vow you make. So if you make a vow and get someone else involved, that individual has no responsibility. He is not supposed to do anything.
Right.
So this is the first point. And the second point, when it comes to revoking the vow made by a wife, okay, the husband is able to dissolve his wife's vow, nazr, if the vow was made without his permission, and similar is the position, of course, with a father who can revoke the vow made by his son, because these are people who sometimes make use of their fathers. Maybe when it comes to the child, he uses his father's money to make a vow. And the husband is dependent on her husband, and she uses her husband's money or property to make a nazr. So without the permission of the husband and without the permission of the father, the vow will be invalid. And I should say that if a child, actually, let's say a son or a daughter, makes a vow without the permission of his father, or even his father, of course, let's say the father, yes, then the vow made by him or her is invalid. And of course, if the father first allows, or the husband allows first, And then after a while, he changes his mind and says, no, you should not do it. I allowed you in the first place, but okay, now I've changed my mind and I don't want you to change. In that case, the husband cannot revoke the vow. Mm-hmm. The father cannot revoke the vow. Yes.
Uh-huh. So, if a husband allow his wife to make a vow, can he prevent her, his wife, from completing the vow to the full?
You are right. That this is what I actually tried to say it. And I said that if a woman makes a vow with the permission of her husband...
If the permission is given...
Yeah, the permission is given. First of all, I said that if the husband gives the permission, then he cannot stop her. And he cannot abrogate the vow. He cannot cancel the vow. And of course, he cannot restrain his wife from fulfilling the vow. That's the point, okay? He, the husband, cannot restrain his wife from fulfilling the vow after he gave her permission to make the vow, to make the nasr.
Mm-hmm. I see. Sheikh Sawit, if a person makes a vow to recite the Quran, is reciting the Quran by just looking at the scripts in any position other than the prayer valid? Is one relieved of a vow? And is the fulfillment of such obligation waived?
Well, there is no objection to someone looking at the script of the Quran in and of itself. It is it's okay and it's recommended because there is sawab in just looking at the script of the Holy Quran according to a narration. But when it comes to a vow, if a person makes a vow to recite the Quran, you know, reciting is one thing and just looking at the script is another thing. So the nazr is not fulfilled according to the vow he made, because when he says that I'm going to recite, so looking at the scripture or a script of the Quran is not considered to be recitation. Okay, if a person says, okay, I'm going to just go through the Quran and just read it and without even moving my tongue, and if the vow was made like this, then it is fulfilled. It's okay. If he just looks at the verses of the Quran from the beginning till the end, then it is okay. And of course, I should say it in a nutshell, it depends squarely on the intention, on the intention, because it depends on how you made the formula, how you made the intention. And if you act according to the intention you made in the first place, then the vow is fulfilled.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Javid. And thank you for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.